Hey, Rich, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, you bet. What are we going to talk about? We got enough for about four shows here. How are you managing these unique times we're in America?
It's funny. I mean, everybody, good and bad, probably, it's a struggle. I have, to work with four kids at home, attempting to go to school. So, my mornings are not as productive as they could be, but overall, we've been really lucky. Nobody we know is sick. I still have work and, it could be worse. I know there are a lot of people who, are really going through miserable times, but we're, I don't know. It's family wise. It's been kind of interesting. We're all doing stuff together we wouldn't ordinarily do all the time. Mm. So, that's good. How about you?
Four kids. Wow. See, I got one and I feel like the plate spinner on the old Ed Sullivan show.
How old is yours?
He's six.
Oh, okay. So is he doing Zoom classes and all that stuff?
No. His class, he's in kindergarten, and they've had a couple of meetings. Right. He wants no part of that. He'll watch from the other side of the room. He doesn't participate. He's like, no. No, thank you.
Yeah. Good for him, and good for you, because you don't have to manage his academic career at this point.
No, he's moved on. He said, I'm a first grader now. That's behind me. Great. That's kind of how I handled college. I just declared that I was out.
My youngest is in sixth grade, and he checked out without telling us right at the start of the virus. And he's like the only one who's ever been a really conscientious student. And all of a sudden we got this email, and they're like, Francis hasn't turned in 55 to 60 assignments. And we were like, okay. So it's like whack-a-mole. It's like anytime, you think everybody's doing well, the one who you don't think.
That's how it always is.
The problem.
Well, a lot of things I want to cover with you today. Let's start with the story you mentioned to me online a little while ago. We had Gilbert Gottfried on back early in the year. You've got what sounds like a really interesting Gilbert Gottfried story.
Yeah, I mean, it's like honestly one of my favorite things that, when I kind of go like, wow, I have a good job, and I get to do all kinds of weird stuff. So this is, I can't remember the year, it's probably like 2002 or 3 or something like that. I got assigned by Playboy to do a story about the life and death of Charles Rocket, who got fired for swearing on SNL and was, the first cast after the original, group was all gone. Mm. And I know you're saying he's from Bangor, and it was a horrible, grim story. He was this incredibly talented guy, who had, really difficult inner life that people didn't know about. So there, that was not fun. But I got to, Gilbert was one of the people I interviewed. And I don't know, what it was like if you talked to Gilbert off air, but my experience of him was that he is a fairly mild person, mm-hmm. not at all like his on-air persona. And, so I interviewed him like 3 times. And, and he'd just be like, very, apologetic and very, he'd be like, is this a good time? Is this a good time, Josh? Is this okay? And I was like, God, it's so funny that this is Gilbert Gottfried. He's this sweet, kind of mild-mannered, shy almost guy. So time goes on. I write the story, and my editor reads it, and he's like, this is just such a horribly grim story. And it was too soon after Charlie's death to really, have perspective. So it got killed, as they say in the business, which is, I got paid and we agreed not to run it. About a month later, I'm driving down the highway I get a call and I answer it, and it's Gilbert. And he goes, Josh, hey, it's Gilbert Gottfried. Is this a good time? Is this okay? And I said, yeah, of course, this is a fine time. And he's like, oh, God, I just, you wanted to find out, what happened with, your story about Charlie, when it's going to run, and, what issue I can pick up. I said, Gilbert, I hate you helped me so much with this. I hate to tell you this, but the story was killed. And there was, dead silence. And he became Gilbert Gottfried. And he goes, Oh, and I will do the worst imitation. And he goes, oh, my God. He goes, your story got killed by a porno magazine? He goes, wait. I know a guy at Hustler who might be willing to take this story. And I'm driving and I'm like, oh, my God. He goes, no. You know who has great articles? Leg Show. He goes, that's the one you ought to do. And literally, I'm just dying, because it's almost like he's been setting me up for the entire time we've been talking to each other for this moment. He's never done the Gilbert voice. And he just sat there, and literally I spent like 8 minutes driving on a highway, veering all over the place with Gilbert naming every dirty magazine that was ever published and suggesting, you know, where the article could go in between, you know, what layouts and things like that. But it was just so great. And I remember like literally pulling off the highway in Chicago because I couldn't drive anymore. And when we got off, I couldn't stop laughing. And all I could think was, you know, okay, this is good. This is, you know, like the worst assignment I've ever had. And this just turned into one of the, you know, most fun things that I've ever,
love it. Yeah, we didn't know what to expect. He's got the reputation of being in character when he does interviews, and we weren't sure, and he started that way, and then he let down his guard fairly quickly, and we talked with him a little bit about the documentary, and he was great. I mean, he was still funny, but it was in his normal speaking voice, and I found him to be a really engaging guy.
Oh, he was great. I mean, he was, and it was, you know, just one of those things where you remember how really funny people are. You know, like, you know, some people are, you know, can be really funny, but people who are funny like him can just turn it on at a moment's notice and just kill you. And that was, you know, it was just such a great experience. It was like I was having my own personal Friars Club roast of me impromptu driving down the Kennedy Expressway. So
we're talking with Josh Karp here on Downtown. Let's talk a little bit more about the Charlie Rocket story, because it's fascinating. Like, he's from Bangor, although nobody seems to know when he was here or how long he spent in Bangor. And the whole Saturday Night Live story, you know, if it happened now, I'm not sure anything would happen. Heck, it's happened to other people. He dropped an F-bomb, which, from what I've read along the way, may or may not have been intentional anyway, but the backstory on him is pretty fascinating too.
Yeah. And you know, it's such a, you know, it was, I mean, I tend to deal with, you know, subjects that are not super heavy. Even, you know, in cases of people dying, you know, it's usually not as difficult as Charlie's story was writing about. But first of all, I think really was not that, you know, it's always been said that Bill Murray swore on the show and that Paul Schaefer swore on the show before Charlie did. But Charlie kind of took the fall for that cast. And I seem to remember they got rid of everybody except for Eddie Murphy, who kind of joined the cast mid-season. And that was the season that it was, I think, John Demanian had taken over for Lorne Michaels. And it was just a mess. I mean, the show was not, you know, it was not going well. And they, you know, realized only Eddie Murphy was salvageable. But Charlie was the star that year. And, you know, his back, you know, his story before that was really exceptional. You know, in working on that story, I got to interview Chris France from the Talking Heads, and Gus Van Sant, the filmmaker, both of whom had gone to Rhode Island School of Design with Charlie. And, you know, it's one of those things, you know, like when you hear great athletes say, you know, that guy was better than me. And that was the general consensus. I mean, he went to school with all these incredible, you know, incredibly talented artists and, you know, who had, you know, a great deal of success. And he was the guy. He was the one they thought, you know, like, he could do anything. I interviewed, he was one of 8 siblings. And, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, you interviewed half of them and they had a perfectly normal life. And then you interviewed the other half, and it was, you know, really, you know, difficult, horrible childhood. But, you know, keeping up appearances. I remember his sister telling me that you weren't allowed to look in a mirror in the house if you were a kid, because that was, you know, some forbidden, you know, show of vanity. And so That was really tragic. And then, you know, he went on to have, you know, a pretty good career as an actor. He was on Moonlighting, you know, he played Bruce Willis's brother, he was in Dumb and Dumber. You know, he was somebody who always worked, and he was a guy who was a, you know, talented artist on the side, the one thing I always took away was that everybody you talked to said he was the most stable person they'd ever known. He was the person, you know, he was married for, you know, from, you know, college on, I think. He had one son. But he was like, you know, he was this smart, loyal, stable guy who everybody went to all the time for, you know, when they were in trouble or when they needed advice and stuff. And I think inside, the combination of, you know, of what he'd gone through as a child, the way he kind of compensated for it, and then the thing that happened with Saturday Night Live, you know, when I started out, I was like, you know, that, you know, the thing with Saturday Night Live couldn't have killed him. You know, that could not have been it, because that just seems almost too, you know, crazy. You know, that's like such an obvious explanation.
Right.
But one of the things that I did find out was that the morning he killed himself, he had finally agreed to do an SNL reunion show, which he had always refused to do. And there was actually like a limo from Saturday Night Live waiting in his driveway in Connecticut to take him to tape his segment when his wife noticed he was missing. So it was such a horrible story. I mean, you know, it was just one of those things where your heart just went out to somebody, and it was, you know, just really, you know, kind of really, really a sad story. But he was an exceptional guy who was really talented, and I think, you know, just beat himself up over this thing that was, you know, he got the biggest break a guy in that business can get. Mm-hmm. And then it disappeared kind of almost just by somebody's whim that he was the one, you know, that was going to be the thing they'd fire everybody over.
Let me ask you about Bill Murray. How many times have you interviewed him through the years?
You know, I've never actually interviewed him. I spoke to him once briefly on the phone over a totally, this is kind of funny. I live, 3 miles from where Bill Murray grew up. And I caddied very briefly at the country club, where he caddied. The Caddy Shack is based on, my father-in-law and he both went to the same Catholic high school in Chicago, the suburbs, called Loyola Academy. And one of my father-in-law's best friends grew up with Bill. And on several, and let's see, at least 3 different occasions, I had reason to want to interview him. And each time he, this guy would be like, I'll try to do what I can. And it was every Bill Murray, trying to get a hold of Bill Murray story you've ever heard, except it's the one where he doesn't show up at the end. Somehow magically, when I went to interview him for the National Lampoon book, I recall they had a class reunion, and he told my father-in-law's friend, he said, you know what, he's like, give me the guy's number, give me his email, he's like, I want to talk to him, he says, I intend to talk to him, but you just got to understand, I'm probably never going to talk to him, because that's just how I am. that literally has been the setup every time. And then what happened was I got involved in a project of just an associate producer helping people get comedy people for a documentary about this famous comedy teacher from Chicago. And they said, you know, God, if you could get Bill Murray, and Bill had studied with this guy and knew him very well, and I think accepted, you know, honorary degree from someplace for him when the guy was sick. And
was it Del Close?
Yeah, it was Del Close, absolutely. Yeah. And so I thought, you know, and I was like, well, you know, see, and I was like, I don't know if I want to cash in all my Bill Murray chips on this, but, you know, I'll give it a shot. And this was the first thing that he really responded to, right? So he said, he's like, yeah. He's like, give me the guy's number. So, you know, one day I get some call from a place. I still have it on my, my voicemail. which it will die with my phone. and you know, and I get this message, and you know, and he's like, you know, hey, hello, Mr. Karp. This is a friend of, you know, my father-in-law's friend's name. He said that I went to, you know, St. Philip's or whatever, you know, school they've gone to. He's like, please call me back. And so I was like, there are about five people in the last 20 years where I've really just been like massively nervous to speak to them. and each time it's worked out really oddly. And, you know, the most comparable person was Jack Nicholson, which was just absolutely terrifying. And I was like a blithering idiot during. So he called. Eventually he said, you know, text me when's a good time to call. I texted him a good time to call. He called a totally other time. You know, like, he's like, oh, yeah, I'll call then. And then he called me a different time, Bill Murray did. And we got on the phone, and you know, he said, so what's the deal? And I said, you know, we're doing, you know, I'm kind of helping out with this documentary about Del Close. And he said, you know, well, so what's the deal? And I told him a little bit about it. And he said, now, why are you involved? And I said, oh, you know, I wrote, you know, I co-produced a documentary with somebody who works with the producer. And I, you know, and they knew I'd written a book about Doug Kenny. And, you know, and that's why. And he just went totally stone cold.
No.
and he said, well, I'm going to have to read that book. And that was it. And
wow.
I was, you know, and I was trying to kind of make up for it, but it was not salvageable. Nicholson went a lot better, by the way. The consolation.
Wow.
But it was, yeah. So, you know, and I mean, and I get it too. You know, I mean, everybody wants a piece of the guy, you know, and he does what he wants. You know, and if something bugs him, he's just, you know, you never know when you catch somebody on a bad day. But, you know, it was one of the few things. I mean, I've had a lot of people, you know, in my, you know, my job, but, you know, you kind of have a lot of people close doors on you. It doesn't usually stick with you like that. I was just like, oh, Bill Murray, no. Like, my kids are like, how is Bill Murray? And I'm like, I don't want to talk about it.
Oh, that's awful. Well, I want to talk about some of the things you've got coming up. Some interesting projects, to say the least. You're working on a story about the making of Caligula?
Yeah, I wrote it and for Airmail, which is Graydon Carter from Vanity Fair's new like online magazine. And what happened was I filed it right before the virus hit. And everything, you know, has come before it as a result, because they do so much, you know, virus coverage and so much political coverage all of a sudden. So I'm waiting for that to be published. But yeah, it was, you know, I've done a lot of making of stories. So it was kind of like a, you know, one of those things where it's like, okay, well, there's a weird, you know, weird backstory. And it sure was. I mean, it was really, you know, one of the odder things. I mean, I remember seeing that movie in high school. You know, my friends, you know, we were like, yeah, I think it was like 1980 or something. I was like 14. I was at boarding school, and then we, you know, got out, and we were unsupervised, and we were like, oh, let's, you know, sneak in to see Caligula. And, you know, we thought like, oh, wow, this is going to be like, you know, this is going to be like, you know, like looking at Playboy, but better, right? And it was so friggin' gruesome. And, you know, and whatever sex there was, it was so weird. And so much stuff happened that I honestly think all of us were kind of like, okay, we're just not going to talk about what happened.
We just had a conversation the other day about what was the more unhinged performance by Malcolm McDowell? Was it Clockwork Orange or Caligula?
It's funny. I interviewed him, and he was really, he was just great. I mean, he was really, really one of the, you know, he was really engaged in talking about it, got how crazy it was and how funny it was. But also, you know, was disappointed in what happened. But yeah, I mean, he really let it fly in that movie. and he was really great. You know, I think he sees the humor in that. Helen Mirren was also, she was funny. She was just like, you know, she's Helen Mirren, and, you know, she's sitting here talking about, you know, this, you know, insane, semi-pornographic, big-budget movie she was in, and I think she described it as what she said it was like an irresistible mix of art and genitals or something, like as only she could say it. But yeah, it was nuts. I mean, you know, because it was originally Roberto Rossellini, of all
wow.
people. Yeah, he had written a treatment for this, and he wanted to do, you know, a thing about Caligula that was really more about Rome in those days and how really bad it was to be a peasant, you know, under that kind of rule. And he decided he wasn't going to do it, and his nephew, who I think was named Franco, took it to Gorby Dal, who was, right? I mean, that's
a logical right next step, right? Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, I think the thinking process was he had done some rewrites on Ben-Hur, and he lived in Italy. and he was, I guess, you know, he had written, you know, his story, you know, he had a big interest in history and things like that. So they took it to him. He signed on to do it, and he wrote the script. And then the script, and in fact, Malcolm McDowell told me the story about how he, you know, Gorby Dal kind of, you know, charmed him into taking this role. And he said, well, you know, but who's the money behind it? And he said, don't worry. He said, you know, come have lunch with me in London at the Penthouse Club. And he's like, the Penthouse Club? And he's like, yeah, the Penthouse Club. And so they go there, and he goes, I'm, you know, that man over, you know, over there is Bob Guccione. He's the, you know, the financier. And, you know, Malcolm McDowell goes, the pornographer? And he goes, think of them as the Warner Brothers, all of them. And Guccione was like, you know, he was the single largest investor, I believe, in both The Longest Yard and Chinatown.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, which is just crazy. And he, you know, he was like this really, you know, his backstory was just totally wild because he had been an artist, like who was, you know, like a real painter. He wasn't making much of a living. He had a family, and he started Penthouse because he was living in London and he saw that there wasn't anything, I guess, kind of any on the other side of obscene from Playboy. And so he started kind of pushing the boundary, and he sold out everything like immediately. So by the mid 70s, all of a sudden he's got an empire, and he was one of the wealthiest men in America, if you can believe that. And he was really an astute businessman. And so he invested, you know, in a couple movies, and they were, you know, huge successes. And I think, you know, it's kind of the old story of, you know, like, okay, let's, you know, the business is going legit kind of thing, right? So we're going to become real movie producers. And yet I think, you know, kind of the whole story is the story of the clash between his instincts as an artist and as a pornographer. And it really is. I mean, you know, they talked about having John Huston direct it. They talked about having Lena Wertmuller direct it. And she wanted to rewrite the script and name it Lena Wertmuller's Caligula. And they couldn't do it because it was already going to be called Gorby Dal's Caligula. That was in his contract.
Wow.
Yeah. And it just got crazier from there. My favorite thing is Peter O'Toole. Yeah, they hired this guy to direct it named Tinto Brass, who had directed these kind of weird, you know, kind of Italian softcore porn movies that were, you know, set in like Nazi Germany and things like that. And just totally weird, kind of satirical, you know, stuff, but, you know, definitely pornography. And so he's directing it. He hated Guccione, and his whole purpose was to screw over Guccione. Meanwhile, they hire Peter O'Toole. And he hates the director, of course. Everybody loves him, though. And when John Gielgud, who's in it, shows up, O'Toole just walks across the room in front of everybody, goes, well, God, I like first I did Gilbert Gottfried, now I'll do Peter a bad Peter O'Toole. But he said something like, he goes, Johnny, what's a knight of the realm like you doing in a porno movie? And that was kind of his whole take on everything. So he was impossible, and everybody was impossible, and, you know, and then Guccione reshot the movie afterwards, like, because there wasn't enough, like, of the sex he wanted, so he did it, and then he edited it, and it was just total madness.
Wow. Well, I look forward to to reading about that when the time comes. And also, this is a fascinating project you're working on about the Pittsburgh Crawfords, one of the great teams of baseball history.
Yeah, that's, you know, I've kind of, you know, after I had finished up the Orson Welles book I worked on, and then, you know, participated in a couple film projects, I'd had in the back of my mind for a long time that that would make a great story, because it's this, you know, weird combination of something like, you know, if you're going to compare it to TV, it's like, you know, the movie 42 about Jackie Robinson meets like Peaky Blinders or something like that, because it's just this bizarre story, because the Crawfords were owned by a guy named Gus Greenlee. And just to explain who they were the best team in the Negro Leagues and possibly, you know, the history of baseball. And they existed for a fairly short period of time, like 1932. Their greatness was between 32 and 37. And they met a completely bizarre end, but I'll try to remember to explain. But their roster was Josh Gibson, you know, the arguably, you know, certainly the greatest home run hitter in the Negro Leagues. Satchel Paige, you know, arguably the greatest pitcher, certainly in the Negro Leagues, and maybe, you know, one of the greatest pitchers ever. A guy named Oscar Charleston, who nobody really talks about, but if you look at, you know, say like Bill James, who's, you know, the big baseball stats guru, he's listed as the fifth greatest player.
Yeah, we had a guy on a couple of months ago that's written a biography of Oscar Charleston.
Right. I read that. It's a terrific book. And so I'm sure he, you know, he probably talked about, you know, Charleston was, he was Willie Mays if Willie Mays had Ty Cobb's temper.
Right.
Or if Ty Cobb was black. He was just the toughest, you know, guy who ever lived. And he was so great because there are, I'm sure this guy, you know, the author talked about it. But, you know, there were all these, you know, stories, you know, of him, you know, they got off the train in some town in the South, and there's a whole team and a bunch of Klansmen met them at the station to run them out of town. And he, as I recall, he kind of looked around and he's like, which one of you guys is in charge? And he tore off the guy's hood and punched him in the face, and everybody went running. And, you know, he was, you know, just this totally defiant, you know, figure. And, you know, additionally, they had Cool Papa Bell, who's, you know, the, you know, famously the turned off the lights and got into bed before the room was dark, you know, the fastest guy who ever lived, and Judy Johnson, and all five of those guys are Hall of Famers. But the story, you know, that I was really interested in is, first you've got, you know, this is just before Jackie Robinson, you know, 10 years before that, 15 years before, and people are talking about integrating baseball. And you've got Gibson, who thinks he's going to be the guy. Satchel Paige, who kind of thinks he's going to be the guy, but isn't sure, you know, if he'll get there. And then Oscar Charleston, who knows he's never going to be the guy because he's too old. And they're on the field together, and they're intersecting lives through this period, because it's, you know, it's this incredible, you know, Gibson's story is tragic, and, you know, kind of he dies right before Robinson plays his first game, and, you know, he dies of a brain tumor, but it's really, you know, kind of viewed as he was driven mad by the inability, you know, to be the person who integrated baseball, and by his lack of recognition for what he was so good at. You know, Paige is like the ultimate survivor. And then Charleston is just, you know, this, you know, guy who really basically likes to play baseball and fight. And enjoys fighting possibly more than baseball. And he's just totally defiant. And their lives are amazing because in the North, you know, they kind of live this weird, separate but equal celebrity life.
Right.
In the South, when they go barnstorming or do spring training, it's still it's the Jim Crow South. And then they go in the winter, they go to the Caribbean, where they're gods. And they can do whatever they want. They're above everybody else. And so, you know, it's the story of their lives, and then also the owner, who is a guy named Gus Greenlee, who is a numbers runner, which is, you know, that was kind of like an illegal lottery. And he ran this jazz club in the area and got it in his mind, you know, in Pittsburgh, in this area called The Hill, that he was going to just start the greatest baseball team, you know, he could start. And across town was a guy named Cumberland Posey, who owned the Homestead Grays, who were kind of the Yankees of the Negro League.
Right.
And they were owned, Cumberland Posey was an aristocrat. He was an aristocratic black guy in Pittsburgh. His family was the wealthiest family in Pittsburgh. And he was tough, and he was ambitious, and he was a great athlete. And Greenlee just stole half his team from him after he got Satchel Paige. So the two of them spent the next 5 years fighting for control of the league and control of the players. Greenlee has this amazing team. He restarts the whole league with other numbers runners as the owners, because that's the only way they can finance it. Satchel Paige just kind of vanishes whenever he wants to play for another team and get paid better. And the whole thing, you know, at 35, I think, was their great season where they were just, you know, better than the 27 Yankees. But it all ended because in 37, during spring training in New Orleans, a guy approaches Satchel Paige wearing a white, you know, white suit, you know, what, Panama suit or whatever. And he says, you know, hey, you know, Trujillo would like you to come down and play for the national team in the Dominican. And Satchel Paige is like, oh, okay. And he offers him a ton of money. And Paige brings down Cole Papabel, and he brings down Josh Gibson. And it turns out they're basically, if they don't win, they're going to get killed.
Exactly. Yeah, we talked to a guy who wrote a book about that experience, too.
Right. That's a terrific book as well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, it's a combination of what those guys wrote about, you know, with Gibson and with, and then with the, you know, the story of them being on this incredible team together. And I think, you know, my thought has always been that kind of less about, you know, the baseball and just more about what a, you know, an experience the three of these guys being on this team owned by a numbers runner were, and, you know, and what it was to be, you know, the two owners, you know, were guys who would have been, you know, millionaires in white, if they were white. You know, everybody is hamstrung by this whole, you know, all of them are told their whole lives, if only you were white. So, you know, it's about what that life was like, you know, in that place and time.
That's awesome. I look forward to hearing more about that. So much more I want to talk about. Well, we got to have you come back again in a few weeks, because I want to talk about two other projects that you're working on, and also want to go back and chat with you about Chevy Chase and about, for my money, the most interesting guy from that Animal House crew, Bruce McCall, who's probably carved out the most consistent career of everybody.
Yeah, no, Bruce McCall was great. I mean, just a really interesting guy and a great, you know, life story. And it's kind of funny that given the way the world is now and how we all want to live in Canada. And Bruce, I remember telling me that, you know, he grew up in, I think, Simcoe, Ontario, and he would just envision that in America, everything was in Technicolor and all the kids were riding brand new Schwinn bikes and all the driving Corvettes because it seemed so animated down here compared to what life in Canada was like. You know, and now we're all just like, oh, you know, if only we could have the relative calm of living in Canada.
Absolutely. Hey, Josh, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Anytime. It was my pleasure. Thank you.